Hey there, Mike Stelzner coming to you with a fascinating update you might not be familiar with. Did you know that Social Media Examiner can deliver all the marketing training, news, and trends, insights that you need into your inbox 3 days a week when you sign up for our newsletter, and it's completely free? Simply visit socialmediaexaminer.com/getupdates and take your marketing to the next level.
Welcome to the Social Media Marketing Podcast, helping you navigate the social media jungle. And now, here's your host, Michael Stelzner.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much for joining me for the Social Media Marketing Podcast, brought to you by socialmediaexaminer.com. I'm your host, Michael Stelzner, and this is the podcast for business owners and marketers who want to know what works with social media. I am really stoked about today's show. I'm going to be joined by Robert Cialdini. Yes, the Robert Cialdini, author of the seminal book on persuasion entitled Influence. This show will, and I kid you not, completely change your entire perception of influence and persuasion. He's got a brand new book out, and we talk about stuff that is very, very groundbreaking. I was completely blown away by the interview. You can email me at any time at podcast@socialmediaexaminer.com. That comes straight to my inbox, and I try to respond to everybody. Now let's transition over to this week's brand new discovery.
Helping you stay alive in a social jungle, here's this week's survival tip.
This week, I'm joined by Eric Fisher with a brand new discovery. What'd you find, Eric?
This week, I have found assistant.to.
Assistant.to. What is that exactly?
Well, you know how there's been a crop of these tools that take the pain out of scheduling, where you're going back and forth, email to email to email over and over again. Does this work? No. Does this work? Maybe. Well, and then there's been those like Calendly and Schedule Once and a few others. Assistant.to is actually a native plugin that you add to your Gmail, and then it just has access to your Gmail, your Google Calendar, and you can select a couple different places right by pressing a button inside your Gmail and offering up a few times, and then they get populated right into the email you're writing.
Interesting. And what happens when you send the email? Does the person somehow pick one of them and it automatically assigns it to your calendar?
Yes, because it does this really cool kind of smart communication between Gmail account to Gmail account by knowing which time zone I'm in versus which time zone you're in. And so they will look like the times that I selected on my end and then transform into the ones you need to pick from on your end.
Have you either been the person using this to set up interviews, or have you been on the receiving side of this?
I have been on the sending side, and it's worked great.
I mean, explain how it works. How does it work from your side when you're sending something?
Yeah, it's real easy. I mean, you just you type it, you know, put in the person's address in the sending section, and then as you're writing the body of the email in Gmail, and I should say this is on the desktop version of Gmail,
right?
You will see a little A once you've installed this, and you click that, and then it brings up the little hover over that lets you select different it shows you your availability, because you're going to connect this with your Google Calendar. It shows you what meetings you already have scheduled. You can select two, three, four, however many different time chunks that you want to give them options for, and then you just click add, and it copy pastes that right into the body of the email.
And on the recipient side, they just select one and it somehow automatically adds it to the calendar. And do they get an email notification, or do you know how that part works?
Yeah. So they get on the receiver side of things, they receive all those times are clickable. And then what that does is it then talks to the server side of things that connects both ends.
Right.
And it confirms it, and then it sends the confirmation to both sides. Okay, this is when the meeting is, and it drops it on both calendars.
Sweet. So is it free? What does it cost?
It's free. It's surprisingly free.
So how do we find this thing?
So how you find it is you go to assistant.to.
And you're going to want to do this from a desktop, and then somehow it allows you to add this extension into your Gmail account is what I hear you saying.
That's right.
Assistant dot, what was the rest of it?
T-O.
Assistant.to. Well, thank you, Eric, for assisting us with our scheduling possibilities here. Hopefully a lot of people will go try that out.
You're welcome.
Did you know that we can deliver awesome marketing info directly into your inbox? Simply subscribe to our weekly newsletter that comes out 3 days a week. You won't miss any of the updates going on in the world of social marketing. Visit socialmediaexaminer.com/get updates.
Now, on to an absolutely amazing experience, one that you may need to rewind and listen to again. I'd like to proudly transition over to my interview with Robert Cialdini.
Helping you simplify your social safari, here's this week's expert guide.
I am very excited to be joined today by Dr. Robert Cialdini. If you don't know who he is, he has sold more than 3 million books focused on the psychology of influence and persuasion. He's helped coin a lot of phrases that marketers are familiar with, such as social proof and scarcity. And he's also the CEO of Influence at Work, which is a company that provides speaking, training, workshops all along behavioral psychology and the world of influence for the business world. His latest book is called Persuasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Michael, and your followers.
Well, thank you so much. It's a real, real blessing to have you on the show. So let's go back in the time machine here. Your first book, Influence, and I don't know exactly what subtitle it was, but the first book I think was called Influence. When did you write that book, and what was your initial response when that book came out?
That book was written way back in the middle 80s, and it was designed to find out what were the most successful strategies that influence professionals used to get people to say yes. And it was written actually for the consumer, how to recognize and resist these strategies when they were used in some kind of unwelcome or undue way. The initial response to the book was, let me say, quite mild. So much so that my publisher decided to call back the promotional and publicity funds, advertising funds, to promote the book because, as they said to me, that would be like throwing money down a pit.
Oh my gosh. Well, obviously something changed along the way. What happened?
A couple of things happened. One, I think the biggest thing is that the times changed and the idea of evidence-based decision-making began to dominate the business world. The idea of deciding on how to go forward based not on hunches or anecdotes or war stories, but on the basis of evidence. And the book Influence provided a compendium of evidence as to what factors influence people to say yes. And it was all in this one place. And so suddenly, at about 3 or 4 years after publication, the sales of the book started skyrocketing to bestseller levels where they've stayed ever since.
Well, it's amazing because I first was introduced to your work while I was in grad school, actually. I was I have a master's in communication, and we were studying the whole persuasion side of the argument, and your particular book was kind of the course book for the course that I was in, and I just found it absolutely fascinating. The way you wrote the book, did you do some of the research, but also kind of translate some of the existing research that was going on in the space? Can you kind of give a little insight into that?
There were two sources of information for me. One was the literature in the behavioral sciences, marketing, psychology, communication, management, and so on, as to what factors seem to be especially successful in moving people toward assent. I contributed to that research literature, but it wasn't the only thing I looked at was my own research. I cast a much wider net to try to get the nuggets of information that would be valuable for readers from the widest range of influence researchers. That was one place. The other place I looked, Michael, was beyond the research literature. I began to infiltrate, kind of as a spy of sorts, all of the training programs that I could get access to. sales, marketing, recruiting, fundraising, and so on, to see what was being trained by the pros into their aspiring new professionals as to what worked for them. And I gleaned information from those training experiences that I infiltrated. And together, the research from scientific sources and from the lessons of the influence professionals became the book Influence.
And what a book, what a book, what a book, and what a body of work that you have created. It's just, it's so funny because even while you're talking, I'm remembering something that you coined in the version of the book that I have, which is the third edition, called the Click Whirl. I don't even know if you remember that or not, but something to do with, I think you might've been using a tape analogy or something like that, like click, certain things happen. And when these things happen, we kind of innately respond. Does this phrase ring any bells to you?
Yes, it does. It does have to do with a technology from back in the 80s, and that is the tape recorder, where you click and whirr, out comes some information as a consequence. So it had to do with this kind of automaticity. Say one word or a particular phrase, and it's like clicking a key inside people, and outflows the information and the response that you want.
Now, obviously, it's been a couple decades, and obviously many different iterations of that book. Today, what kind of audiences are, like you said, originally it was like the dark side, right? I mean, it was a little bit of, hey, this is how you can defend yourself against the power of persuasion, but this is also how you can ethically employ certain kinds of persuasion techniques. Are you finding that this book was more received by an audience, a different kind of an audience than you originally intended? I mean, was it really the business world that you expected to latch onto this? And is there any kind of connection between that and your most recent book, Persuasion?
Well, there is a connection. What I found is that the business community was primarily the initial audience for the book. I expected it was going to be consumers, but it was the business community that became attracted to it. They wanted to know what is known scientifically about the factors that incline people toward yes, and how can we include those factors in our messages, in our marketing campaigns, and so on. What's happened is that with that recognition of this very strong interest in not just defending ourselves against influence attempts, but harnessing the most powerful practices and procedures for creating change, that I decided to write the new book, Persuasion, which is designed for people who want to become more influential.
So talk to me a little bit about this book. You know, who is the audience, ideal audience for this book, and what do you hope that they will discover as a result of going through that book?
Well, the ideal audience is, I think, anybody who's interested in increasing the extent to which their messages are successful in moving people in their directions. And of course, that would be salespeople, marketers of both online and face-to-face or direct mail marketers, all of those kinds of individuals, but also just people who are interested in being more influential inside their families, inside their networks of friends, inside the charity boards they might sit on, those kinds of things. It doesn't have to involve a commercial exchange, but we're all in the business of trying to move people toward yes. And so this book uncovers another dimension for influence besides what we say inside our message. This book concerns what we say in the moment before we deliver our message to make people more receptive to the message once we deliver it.
Now, a lot of people listening are like, oh, this is very fascinating. So this book, The Pre, has to do with what happens just before the persuasion happens, is what I hear you saying. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
So give us, how do you define this then? What, you know, is it just simply what you said, or is there more to it? Like, maybe let's expand a little bit about what this concept of persuasion means.
Sure. As opposed to influence, which covers what best to build into a message to get agreement, persuasion describes the process of gaining agreement with a message before it's been sent. Mm. Now, that may seem like some sort of magic, but it's not. It's established science. And the key is the moment before a message is sent that allows a communicator to create a state of mind in recipients that is consistent with the forthcoming message. That step is crucial for maximizing desired change. I'll give you an example. In one study, when researchers approached individuals and asked for help with a marketing survey, only 29% agreed to participate. But if the researchers approached a second sample and preceded their request with a simple persuasive question, "Do you consider yourself a helpful person?" Now 77.3 volunteered to participate in the survey.
Huh. Why do you think that is?
Well, when asked before the request if they were helpful, nearly everyone said yes.
So they have to follow up. They have to be consistent. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes. When the request for help occurred, most agreed to participate in order to be consistent with that recently activated idea of themselves as helpful people.
Wow.
I mean, to go from 29% to 77%, that's unheard of. And it was by just asking a question, a persuasive question.
Huh. Wow. So let's unpack this a little bit. How do we actually do this? How do we know what questions to ask or what things to talk about to kind of prepare the recipient or recipients to be more open to the next request?
Great question. It's a two-step process, and it involves reverse engineering the typical strategy or sequence of persuasion. First of all, we have to decide what our major strength is. What is the feature of our message that most would benefit someone from choosing what we have to offer? What is the aspect of what we have? Is it reliability? Is it durability? Is it cost? Is it quality? What is it? Then we go to the moment before we deliver that message and present an idea or an image that is consistent with that strength. In that moment before, we will then attune people to the message that's about to come to them. Here's a perfect example. There was a study done by an online furniture store. They had furniture that was high quality, comfortable furniture, and then they had lower end furniture that was inexpensive. So they did a little experiment. They sent half of their visitors to a site with a landing page that had as its background a depiction of fluffy clouds, which of course are associated with comfort. Mm-hmm. Right? Those visitors who saw that landing page rated comfort as the most important factor for making a choice of furniture. They searched the site for features related to comfort, and most tellingly, they preferred to make a purchase based on the comfort of the furniture involved. Though there was another set of visitors, they were sent to a landing page that had coins, money, as its background. They rated cost as the most important feature in purchasing a sofa. They searched for price-related information, and they preferred to purchase inexpensive furniture.
Wow. So in this case, it was a random sampling. It's not like they happened to know which consumers were more interested in price and which were more interested in comfort. They were instead more subconsciously influenced by the image. Is that what I hear you saying?
That's exactly right. And here's the scary part of it. Those marketers were able to create a comfort-oriented buyer or a price-oriented buyer by what they presented to them immediately before the choice.
Wow. So we can condition, if you will, our prospects to want what our solution is. That's what I hear you saying, right?
That's the reverse engineering prospect of this. We know what our solution is. Our task is to put people in a state of mind that makes them especially attracted to that dimension, to that strength.
Do you think that some marketers have known this for years? And it's because I think about traditional advertising, and you know, there's some amazingly impressive people inside of ad agencies that are producing billboards and, you know, traditional magazine advertisements that have a lot of these visuals that kind of convey these kinds of things. Do you think this has been kind of an unknown secret in the industry for a long time, and maybe you're just helping the world to see that it's something everyone can benefit from?
Well, you know, I think some advertisers know it, but it's a rarefied few. That is, we'll see examples of it, but the next time they don't use this. Mm. It's like they stumble on it and don't even recognize why it worked this way. The key is that they have to present this image or this concept at the outset, at the top of their material, not inside the case that they're making for it. It's too late there to get optimal influence. We have to make people primed and readied for our powerful argument before they experience it, in order for them to be sensitized, to be attuned to that particular concept.
Do you think that this is only applicable to human to human, you know, salesperson to, I mean, I know in this particular case, this was online. Does the medium ever get in the way of this, or can it be accomplished regardless of the medium?
It can be accomplished regardless of the medium, because whatever we do to draw people's attention to a particular concept makes them see that concept as more important than they did immediately before their attention was drawn to it. Mm. And that's what causes them to then search into the subsequent information that we provide in a particular tactical way designed to fit with this idea of what's important for them. Just as we found in that furniture store study, if clouds were the thing that their attention was drawn to, now comfort became important. If money was the thing that their attention was drawn to, now price became more important for them. Now here's the thing about it, Mike. When they were asked afterwards if the clouds or the coins made any difference in their choice, not one of them thought that it did.
But the science shows that indeed it does. That's impressive. All right. So how do we know what our strengths are? Because like I could see us getting tripped up on this first part of the process here. Any suggestions on
yes.
that? Go ahead.
A crucial point that a lot of organizations, a lot of marketers fail to specifically understand within their group: what is our strength? what is the thing that would make it wise for people to choose us? Now, often that will change depending on the particular group that we're targeting, right? But nonetheless, we can do that if we can segment our market and change it. But it's the case that this is something that we can do if we understand what our strengths are. I just got a message from somebody who said, you know, I read your book on persuasion, and it caused me to change something we did to produce a remarkable impact. He said, my sons are in the Boy Scouts, and we were selling popcorn outside of grocery stores to get funds for the Boy Scouts. And we would, as people would exit, we would say, would you like some popcorn? Would you like to buy some popcorn? And the majority of people shook their heads and walked on by. They had just left the grocery store. If they wanted popcorn, they could have gotten it in the grocery store. Instead, he said, I read what you said about identifying your strength. What is it that we really want? What's our goal here? And so we changed the question to, do you support the Boy Scouts?
Huh.
And now people said yes. And they came over and bought our popcorn. Or if they didn't want our popcorn, they would leave a couple of bucks anyway. Because the key to our message was not popcorn. We weren't selling popcorn. We were selling the Boy Scouts.
Or you could just as easily say, are you interested in keeping kids off the streets? You know what I mean?
Precisely.
Or any of those kinds of things that might play to some of the benefits of being part of this, supporting this thing. It's just amazing. I mean, literally in a few seconds, this can change everything. And that's powerful. What about when it comes to online marketers? I know a lot of us are using forums that require the written word. For example, maybe we're sending an email to a segment of our list. Mm-hmm. Can this also be accomplished in writing?
Yes. Let's take. Of course, it can. The key is to find the places for it. Let's say we send an email with an attachment, and our message is in the attachment. Right. And let's say that what we want is people to be open to change because we've got something brand new for them, right? You know how at the bottom of a lot of emails people have sayings or slogans?
Right.
You read that. I always read those. And then I go and open the attachment. Well, there should be a saying there associated with the reason for opening ourselves up to change. There are many. There's one I like by a British author. He says, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there.
Yeah, or there's a great one by Peter Drucker that says, you can't manage what you can't measure. And I could see opening a message with a popular quote like that, and then perhaps revealing that you happen to have a course on how to analyze your success, right?
Exactly. And there's another one that I love. If instead of looking for change, you're looking for people who want to believe in your experience, not something new, but something that's worked well all along. There's a Chinese adage that goes, the years say what the days can't tell.
Very cool. Wow. This is absolutely amazing. So, let's talk about the ethical side of this, because I know that there is an ethical quandary here, isn't there? And, when we are familiar with ways to influence people, it could be used for good. It could be used for bad, you know?
Right.
So how do we know when we're crossing the line? What should we be thinking about on the ethical side of this?
Right. So again, when we identify the thing in our message that we want people to be especially sensitized to, here's the question we have to ask ourselves. What is it about what I have to offer that will make it most wise for people to choose us? Not the thing that gives us the biggest profit margin, not the thing that makes it easier for us to distribute and sell. No, what's the thing about what we have to offer? Is it our safety? Is it our reliability? Is it our durability? Is it our novelty? What is it? All right. That's the thing that goes first, because that's going to lead people in a direction of making choices that are in their best interests, not just ours.
So in the case of the Boy Scouts, if somebody asks you, do you support the Boy Scouts, but you can clearly see there's a table with popcorn on it or whatever, right?
Yeah, right.
Or do you support the Girl Scouts? I can see myself being stuck in a, ooh, that's a trick question kind of a mode, right? So I might say I do, and I've already purchased some of those cookies last week.
Yeah.
And that would be my way out, I guess, right? Because there's nothing wrong with the actual question itself. But I wonder whether or not some people might read through some of these questions, and there could be backlash for us as marketers if we're not careful about how we ask them. And I guess that comes back to what you said earlier about making sure that we're picking the right things to focus on.
That's exactly right. You hit it on the nail. That is, if we're moving them in the direction of things that steer them to good choices, the best features, right, then they're going to register that offering along the dimension that will benefit them by choosing it. And then they're not going to be resistant to the idea if it steers them in the right direction.
When you were working on this book, by the way, how long did it take you to craft this most recent book, Persuasion?
About 3 years.
And did you go along the similar path to create this book that you did with your earlier book, Influence?
Well, I certainly looked at the literature in behavioral science, and I sampled from it. But instead of infiltrating kind of as a undercover operative the training programs of influence professionals, I went back to my notes to see, well, what were the highest scorers in each of those professions doing? What were the top achievers in each of the arenas that I investigated? What were they doing? And what I found was the aces of these professions, sales, marketing, advertising, recruiting, fundraising, were persuading their audiences. They were acting like expert gardeners. They recognized that it doesn't matter how good the seed is that you want to plant if you haven't pre-treated the earth first, if you haven't cultivated the soil to be receptive to that great seed. So that's what they were doing. They were spending their time thinking about and organizing not just the message, but the moment before the message.
I remember, I think it's in the first chapter of your book, maybe the second chapter, where you talked about a sales guy that you were part of the journey with this guy. Does this ring any bells? And he ended up going out to his car to get something.
Yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Sure. So I was taking training in selling this particular very expensive heat-activated fire alarm system. And people would have us come into their home, and the best salesperson, his name was Jim, would always do the same thing in his sales approach. He would give people a test, maybe a 10-minute test to take. This is usually a couple taking this test of their fire safety knowledge. And while they were in the middle of it, he would slap his forehead and he'd say, "Oh, I forgot some important materials out in the car. Would you mind if I let myself out and back into your home? Because I don't want to interrupt.
Yep.
Your test." And that often required people giving him a key to their front doors. He would come out, leave, come back in, and then he would begin the sales strategy, the sales procedure. And I asked him about it, and he said, "Bob, think, who do you allow in and out of your house at will? By giving them a key, only somebody you trust, right? I wanted to establish trust in the minds of those buyers before I began my messaging." So that's what he did. He persuaded them to see him as a trustworthy source of information before he began sending that information to them. And he was always the top salesperson.
By a huge margin, right?
Easily.
Yeah.
By a huge margin. Yeah.
That's absolutely incredible. Well, we could keep talking forever, but I want people to go out and get your book. I think it's about 400 pages, but there's about 250 pages of content and the enormous index of where you can find out more about all these studies that you reference inside the book. Why don't you tell people where they can get your latest book, Persuasion, A Revolutionary Way to Influence and Persuade, and also where they can reach out to you if they want to find out more about anything else that you've got going on.
Well, of course, it just came out last week, so it's in the bookstores right now, and it can be obtained on Amazon or Barnes & Noble and so on. But to get information about the book and what else we can provide, my website is influenceatwork.com. Influenceatwork is all one word, .com.
Dr. Robert Cialdini, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on today's show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciated the quality of your questions.
Was that crazy? Or was that crazy? Seriously. How cool is Robert Cialdini? Okay, so I know there's a lot that we mentioned there, and maybe you didn't catch it all. Maybe you need to listen to this episode again. But if you want to catch all the notes, we take very detailed notes at socialmediaexaminer.com/218. That stands for episode 218. Don't miss our incredible lineup of future podcasts that we've got coming to you. If you are new to this podcast, hit that subscribe button on your podcast player. This brings us to the end of yet another episode of the Social Media Marketing Podcast. I am your host, Michael Stelzner. I promise to be back with you in the driver's seat next week. I hope you make the absolute best out of your day, and may social media continue to change your world and grow your wings.
The Social Media Marketing Podcast is a production of Social Media Examiner.
Want more good stuff? Sign up for our top-notch social marketing newsletter. We deliver it straight into your inbox 3 days a week. Visit socialmediaexaminer.com/getupdates.